This is the PC Gamer Podcast, episode 164 for February 12th, 2009. Today we talk about Fear 2 Project Origin, rant on Games for Windows Live, check up on the GameStop vs. Dawn of War 2 saga, await details on the new Alien vs. Predator game, and look at who's buying who in the game business world. All that, plus your questions and our playlist ahead. I'm your host and PC Gamer's Reviews editor, Dan Stapleton. We've also got our former editor-in-chief and now a big shot movie writer, Gary Witta.
Hello.
Our intern, Josh Augustine.
Hey, everybody.
And, of course, our producer, Andy Bauman, who has now been with us for a full year.
Yeah, glad to be with you guys for a year. That went by really fast. Holy crap.
So we're also really psyched that the Gary's movie, Book of Eli, starring Denzel Washington, has started filming. Congratulations, Gary.
Wow.
Yes, no one more so than me. I'm very, very excited. They started filming a week or so ago, and everything seems to be going very well, so it's very exciting.
Is that scheduled to be out this year?
No, it'll be out next year.
Okay. And so you're done with your contribution now, having submitted the script, so do you just sit back and watch the fireworks?
I sit back and let everyone else do the very hard work now. writing a script is one thing, but actually making it into a movie is a huge collaborative monster of effort that terrifies me to even think about it. So I'm glad that it's in some way glad that it's actually out of my hands and in the hands of far more competent professionals who are currently bringing it together. So it's going very well from what I hear. I'm very, very excited to see it.
Do you want to give people kind of the basic, you know, plot? Outline or not outline?
Well, I have to be very careful about what I say. I can't really say anything beyond what is already known, which is that it's kind of a post-apocalyptic action thriller with Denzel Washington is the hero and Gary Oldman's playing the bad guy, and it's going to be very cool. Beyond that, I really my hands are tied because you know there's always kind of a shroud of secrecy surrounding these kind of projects, and I'm not. Really officially even authorized to talk about it. So I have to leave it at that. But I think it's going to be very cool. From the little I've seen of it so far, I think it's really going to blow people away. They're doing some absolutely amazing stuff. There's going to be a few things that you've never seen before, and I'm more excited to see it than I've ever been.
Cool. Yeah, we're all looking forward to it. I love the post-apocalyptic setting, which is partially why I'm such a huge Fallout fan. But we're all looking forward to it.
Let me ask you this, Gary. There's sort of an adage that says like a movie gets rewritten three times. You know, you write it, and then they rewrite it during production, and then they rewrite it during post production. Have you ran into that at all yet? Are you excited to see like how it sort of turns out, or is there anything?
Well, they just started filming, so it's still very much you know in the middle of that process. But you know, certainly, yeah, during the development process and pre-production, the script goes through. A number of drafts, as you know, the directors and the stars of the movie and the producers and everyone has their own thoughts on what the movie should be. I mean, all I can really say about that, it's actually been a really positive process. You hear these horror stories, but that has not been the case on this movie at all. I look at the script that they are shooting. I look at the shooting script that we have here, and it is far and away so much better than the original script that I wrote at the beginning and sold to the studio. So through that process, the script is really through the input of the directors and other people that are involved in the movie has really kind of come on leaps and bounds, and it's a much deeper and richer movie than it was when I first wrote it. So that it's actually been a really, really good process.
I'm glad to hear your experience has been better than like the horror stories we've heard, I remember like the Wachowskis, one of their names taken off of I think it was Assassins, that they technically wrote, but by the time it was filmed, they wanted nothing to do with it. So I'm glad this one's coming out better.
Yeah, you hear those kind of stories. I've just been very, very fortunate in that the people that we've had surrounded this movie. The directors, Alan and Albert Hughes, and obviously people like Denzel and Gary Oldman, who, you know, obviously are just immensely talented and so fluent in the language of film and what it takes to make a good movie, that we just have such an army of talent around it that it's just been an incredible process.
I like that you're on a first name basis with Denzel. But anyway, on to gaming stuff. We do have a game that has, you know, cinematic aspirations, which is Fear 2, that has just come out. It came out a couple days ago at retail and is now on sale on Steam as well. Our review is on the cover of our next issue, which the April issue, which just shipped out to subscribers yesterday. I'm actually interested to see how quickly you guys out there start getting it. It seems to really vary based on how close you are to the distribution hub and everything and the mail. It's always kind of hard to gauge like when people are going to start seeing it. So yeah, if you want to post online when you get it, I'd be interested. Anyway, I just had Josh play through the single player demo so that we can actually discuss it. And Josh, I'm curious because there have been, you know, I've read over some other people's reviews now, and there have been some differing opinions on just kind of the essence of it. So, having just come off playing it, what do you think?
I mean, I was pretty impressed with it. I mean, I love the decision to make Alma much more kind of physically aggressive with you. The one point where she actually is like grabbing your arms, it was so much more powerful than just kind of seeing a little girl wandering around corners. So that kind of gets old after a while. And just to have her just in your face looking so evil is just, it's really powerful. And the mech warriors are awesome. I'm sad Evan isn't here because I know he's been wanting like a good mech game for a while. And in the demo, you don't get around in the mech too much, but I could see them doing some really cool stuff with it in the game.
Well, I think you might be a little disappointed on that particular angle of it because there are a couple of mech sections, but I know I just felt like the mechs were very almost businesslike in their implementation. They stomp around, they shoot stuff a lot, but they don't really do anything that you that make you think, oh, this is really cool. You know, it's kind of like a moving turret. You know, it's not that interesting to play after a little while.
Do they have different mechs in the game?
Or is they do, but you only pilot one of them. They have a smaller one that you fight occasionally.
Yeah.
But the big one is the only one you get to ride around in. And you know, it's a very linear game, much like the first one. So you're just kind of in a very constrained corridor that's often kind of hard to navigate around in the mech because it does move slowly and can't jump. So yeah, and it looks cool. You know, I'll give it that. It looks very cool, and it's much like a turret section in the game, and there are also turret sections in the game. So feels a little redundant there. my overall impression of it, not to, you know, completely read the review on the podcast, that's no fun, but the overall impression of it would be that it is very much more of the same with like a few extra things thrown in that aren't anything really special. The problem with a game like that where it feels more like more of the same is that all you really notice when you're playing through it, assuming you played the first one, is the stuff that hasn't improved, that hasn't shown a whole lot of change that you would have expected, or just, you know, it hasn't been shaken up. My impression coming away from it was a little bit negative. You kind of have to step back a little bit and just evaluate it for what it is. And you know, it's pretty good. It's you know, well executed in almost every way. But it just didn't really grab me. The story, you know, it does, you know, show some new exposition around Armacam and their experiments and things, but it doesn't really compare to first discovering who Alma is and how she's connected to everyone in the first game. It's kind of like a tacked on story almost. It doesn't do anything like radically new.
The thing that I always liked about the first game, which I only played. I didn't get very deep into it. I think I played the first few levels. But the one thing that stood out for me and kind of kept me playing for as long as I did was I loved that the weapons had a really kind of meaty feel. Like there was felt like real weight to them when you were firing the guns. A lot of guns in first person shooters kind of feel like plastic toys, but the ones in Fear had a real, I don't know, kind of resonance to them. Is that something that's true in the second one as well?
The sound effects are good. I don't know if you've been listening to our last couple episodes, but we've been doing a segment where we have been playing sound effects from various games, firing the weapons, and trying to identify them based on that. I think that Fears will be identifiable.
I don't even mean just the sound, though, but just like the heft and the way that they control it all. There was a weight to the weapons that I felt was missing from other shooters, and I really liked that.
Right. I don't think it's quite as I don't know what the word is exactly, but it doesn't have quite the same heft to it. I don't think it's a little bit more floaty, I think is the word. It's more like a console game than the first one. That this one, it's a simultaneous release, but it was pretty clearly a console lead in that. One of the big faults with it actually is that it doesn't have save anywhere. It's checkpoint only, which is always really annoying.
Oh, really? That's always such a big deal to me, I think. And a lot of people probably don't think it is, but like, man, when stuff does not have quick save, that's a huge deal.
Right. And it's a really frequent autosave. So you don't lose a whole lot of progress if you die, but it's annoying to not be able to hit F5 and save. And also, it's a frequent autosave, and like every time it saves, it kind of hiccups a little bit for the frame rate wise, which is also annoying. One thing that bugs me a lot about games like that, that when on the console, you know, it says now autosaving, please don't turn off your console. And in this, they changed it to now autosaving, please don't turn off your computer. Was that really a concern that I was going to just hit the power button or yank out the cord? I mean, like, how about just now autosaving? You know, just take off the please don't thing. And it really gives you kind of a console-y feel to it, just the presentation. And, you know, games like Bioshock and Call of Duty 4, like, those were simultaneously developed as well. And they kind of cleaned that stuff up, you know? And they also had Save Anywhere, I believe. Of those games, so you know it could have used a little bit more PC specific polish, but it's not that big a deal. The save anywhere, lack of save anywhere is the big kicker there, which that hurts it all.
But isn't save? I know we've had this conversation before, but isn't save anywhere a bit of a crutch that kind of lets you inch your way through a game?
Yeah,
it is.
But it's something that we
depends on how you
expect.
Use it.
Yeah.
It depends. Yeah, sorry.
No. I was just gonna say it's something that I've come to expect from PC games. And the biggest thing about the autosave system usually is that it always occurs right before a cutscene or something that you can't skip. And so if you die or if you have to replay a section, you have to watch some sort of ridiculous cutscene over and over and over again. And it just totally pulls you out of the experience. So.
I think autosave is, you know, I don't think there's necessarily like an ideological argument for or against it. I think it really depends on how it's implemented on a case-by-case basis. Like an example of a game where I thought it was done really well very recently was in Gears of War 2, where, you know, for my difficulty level, I felt like the autosaving was put at just the exact right amount of frequency that I felt like I'd earned it each time. It wasn't too easy. They weren't too far apart or too closely put together, but I felt like, you know, after every kind of major firefight or every little set piece sequence where I'd achieved something, the autosave kind of came in and you felt like, you know, you could breathe a sigh of relief that you wouldn't have to do that piece again. So I think when it's done well, I don't have a problem with it. And I have found when a manual kind of save anywhere is available, that it is easy to kind of like inch forward, shoot a bad guy, save. Inch forward, shoot the next bad guy, save. And, you know, when the crutch is there, very often you will use it. And it takes some of the fun out for me. I think there's a little bit less of a sense of achievement.
I think that's true, but, you know, that's only if you allow yourself to abuse it, which I personally never do. What annoys me about the autosaves is that it forces you to replay a part of the game to get up to the part where you keep dying. And that part, that's the part that gets really old.
Yeah.
The part that's, that isn't challenging.
Agreed.
It's just going through the motions again and again to get to the part that is challenging. And then you keep, like, even if it's something where you die immediately, you know, you walk into a room and get shot, and, you know, you're still trying to figure out what's going on. You walk into a room, get killed, and then in order to figure out even what happened, you have to go through the same thing again, and then look around, and then you might get killed again. Then you have to go through that same boring part again. You know, I agree. It does depend a lot on where those save points are. If they save them right before the difficult parts, then it's not that big a deal. It's still
the other reason why autosave, I think, is sometimes used is because as a design issue, if you put save anywhere in the game, then you may have to design around that because it may be possible for the user to save themselves at a point where they kind of screw themselves.
True.
You know, if you save yourself where you've got like 1% of health left, or you save yourself at a point where you just went through a door that you can't go back through, or something like that, you can put yourself into trouble. And so if you want to avoid any potentially game-breaking situations like that, the designers have got to go an extra mile to make sure that the design is robust enough that you can save anywhere without screwing yourself. So I think for that reason as well, autosave is probably becoming more popular.
I think that's actually an argument against autosave, because if you do something and somehow screw yourself and then hit an autosave point, then you're totally screwed. But with save anywhere, or with, you know, most save anywhere schemes, not just the quick save, but with save anywhere, you can create save points that you can go back to.
No, but I don't think that's true, though. I mean, in games that I've played where you do have both, I think the Half-Life games do it. They let you save anywhere, but there are also there are checkpoints that when you go to your reload game, you will see an option to either go back to whatever the last autosave was or whatever the last manual save key that you pressed was. So you always have that choice.
So that's interesting. The point you bring up, Gary, Rock Paper Shotgun did a little blurb about how they think it's really cool that if you get yourself in a really sticky situation with the quick save and you keep reloading, and then eventually you get out of it, it's like this really big feeling of elation and cool that, you know, you can only get from screwing yourself into some sort of bad save point. And a game that I remember having that happen was Max Payne, certainly. And you could definitely screw yourself. You quick save in the middle of a dive right as you take a shotgun to the face. And then you reload it. And one of the reloads, the enemy will miss you with like half of the spray and you'll survive it. And then you'll have to like get back to your feet. And but that was a game that actually had two quick saves, but sometimes you would double tap it and really mess yourself up.
There were times when I would just get out of a big firefight in one of the Half-Life 2 episodes and just kind of as an instinct would like hit the autosave buttons. Oh, finally, I'm through it. But then realize that I've got 1% health and 1% armor and there's nothing around to replenish it with. And I'm kind of screwed because now I can't get through the next firefight. And I've actually proceeded quite a bit since the last autosave. So I either try to struggle through with the 1% health that I've got, which is very difficult, or jump all the way back to the last autosave and have to go through all that again. So, you can screw yourself.
Absolutely. But just to be clear, Fear does not have a save anywhere option at all.
Oh.
It has only the autosaves. And it does allow you to, once you've beaten the missions, to go back and start from a point in that mission, or start from, I think, several points in that mission. But, like, not being able to go back to like a specific point that you want to be able to reload from, I think that's an inconvenience that PC gamers are not used to. On consoles, most people are used to that, but on PC, not really.
So, say you wanted to go back to like if you wanted to drive a mech again, you can't after you finish the game. Like, say, I want to go back to this level and this part.
You can go back to that level, not specifically that part.
Okay, yeah, that is a bummer.
Yeah, and also you don't have the same weapon loadout that you had when you went there. You start with some generic weapons.
I think Call of Duty 4 did that. Like every now and again, I like to blow off some steam by going back to the C-130 mission where you're blowing people up through the targeting camera. And I didn't do any manual saving there, but it just captures all the checkpoints as you go through. And once you've completed the game, you can go back and jump into pretty much any segment you want, which is fun because, you know, I don't necessarily want to play through the entire game again. Great game though it was, But sometimes I like that C-130 section. Sometimes I like the sniper section. You can just go back in and have a little buffet of the parts of the game you enjoyed.
Right. And, you know, I think that a little bit of both is the best combination. I mean, having autosaves so you don't have to keep saving if you forget to save, because I've had that happen a lot of times, especially in RPGs, where you get make a lot of progress and then die, and it's like, oh crap, I haven't quick saved in the past 2 hours, and suddenly you're really pissed off because you've lost 2 hours of your life you'll never have back. So it's a combination of the two would be best, I think.
Maybe it's a behavioral thing that I've picked up from playing a lot of console games these days, where, you know, you don't have that option. But even when I play a PC game, I remember when I played, I think probably the last big shooter I played through on PC was Half-Life Episode 2. And even though there's a quick save option there, I don't think I ever used it. I was perfectly happy to rely on the autosaves because they were intelligently and generously enough placed through the game that I never felt like I had to rely on any additional save points of my own beyond the ones that were already plotted into the game.
Yeah, I agree. It's great to not have to rely on it, but it's also annoying when it's not there.
I think a console owner, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, though, Dan, but I think someone who would advocate from the console side would say that it is a crutch, and you are being a bit of a wuss by saying that you need more save points than the game that has already designed into it.
Well, to that,
and then I would. Then that, I would laugh at the console person for saying that I need crutches.
And then I would say play Stalker and GLHF without quick save.
Right. And also turn off auto aim on your gamepad and tell me who's using a crutch. But if they even let you turn off the auto aim. Boom. So anyway, Fear 2 is definitely, you know, it's a solid game. You know, Josh enjoyed just the demo. I recommend checking out the demo. It's an interesting demo where they've sewn together several different scenes from the game. There's no actual one level in the game that has that plays out just like the demo. And it's actually kind of nice to see somebody taking that approach to demos again, as opposed to just cutting out a scene from the game. Because that way you get kind of a taste of everything it has to offer, like all the best things it has to offer, rather than just a section that might not have the mech in it, for example. And that's for some people, that's really cool. You know, that's that would be a highlight of the game for them. So
is it scary in the same way that the first one tried to be?
I think it is. It doesn't, like I said, the story isn't quite as good. It's not as unsettling story wise. A lot of the stuff they did in the game. Like having Ulma kind of, you know, flash for a couple frames in there that you know, kind of unsettles you, and the sound effects are really good, and just a lot of the ghostly imagery is cool. I found myself kind of creeped out by it, and you know, I'm not somebody who gets like I don't find a lot of horror movies scary just by, you know, buckets of gore. And there are buckets of gore in this, by the way, but that doesn't really faze me at all. But the stuff that's just kind of environmental and just trying to unsettle you, I think they do a really good job of.
Yeah, one thing I wasn't really impressed about in the demo was kind of like your teammates' chatter or whatever. Right. Like, it just, like, three times, I think, the teammate was like, oh, there's a girl. It sounds like she's in trouble. I'm going to go check it out.
Right.
It's just like that over and over. Like, okay, it's kind of lame.
Yeah, they do use that gimmick quite a bit, and the fact that you're a mute, kind of Gordon Freeman-esque, and you can't say, you know, that's the same creepy girl I've been seeing around. Maybe, you know, she like kills a bunch of people. You probably shouldn't go chasing after her. That's kind of a, you know, contrivance of the game form that it is kind of irritating, definitely. But, you know, it's hardly unique to Fear. It's more of a problem with games in general and the way they're written sometimes. But yeah, definitely check out the Fear demo. So the yesterday I had an opportunity to speak with some of the Games for Windows Live reps that you know are in charge of you know running the service, you know, but not the branding, you know, where you see the Games for Windows on top of the game box, but the actual Games for Windows Live service that's used in like Dawn of War 2 is the most recent one, and and also in like GTA 4 and I guess Fallout 3 uses it as well for achievements and things like that. So basically, we're kind of not all that impressed by games for Windows Live lately. Relative to the other services in that same space right now, they're really lagging behind, and they don't seem to have a lot of momentum to catch up. I wanted to go over a few of these things that bugged me. I compiled for them like this big list of gripes I have with it that hopefully they can, take back to Microsoft and say, hey, we need to fix these. These are bothering people. The biggest problem that I have is that there's still no desktop client where you can see if your friends are online and what they're playing and quickly and easily join them like you can with Steam. It's like I fire up Steam, I can see that Josh and Evan are playing Left 4 Dead. It's like, oh, I had no desire to start a game of Left 4 Dead on my own and see, who else is in the game and if they want to join me. But I can see that they're playing, and I'm going to go join their game. That to me is like an incentive to actually play more games, which that's great as far as I'm concerned.
The fact that they haven't come up with that desktop widget, client, app, whatever, the little thing that constantly sits on your system tray, the fact that they still haven't added that, when it's so clear, the usefulness of it is so clear from the way that Steam has implemented it and the way that it's always on when you're playing on your Xbox or whatever, it's an omission so staggering that I can't even begin to comprehend it. Like I honestly can't. I would love to hear them explain to me why they haven't done it. It has to be a choice, because clearly it can be done. It's a very easy thing to implement. I can't for a second begin to understand why they haven't done it.
Yeah, and that was on the top of my list of why is this so? Because
have you asked them?
I did. I mean, this was kind of a one way thing. This was like them asking me for feedback. What are the things I would like to see fixed? So hopefully in the future we'll have some more two way communication there. But for now this was just a one way thing. But the other thing that what you were saying was that it is obviously very easy to do this. You can log into live.xbox.com and see your friends list and see who is online and who is not and what they're playing. But they can't put something like that on my desktop for some reason. Or even a plugin for live Messenger or anything like that. And speaking of, why is there no live.gamesforwindows.com? If you go there, it doesn't even redirect you to live.xbox.com. It's just nothing. And you go to live.xbox.com, it's talking about all the great Xbox stuff that you've got.
I think the excuse they gave for that not having that widget, I remember reading something about this recently, and it didn't make any sense to me, but it was something about, oh, well, if you, because how your live account is for both games for Windows and Xbox. It's all one unified gamer score and right. One system. They were saying, oh, well, if you're logged into Xbox 360... or also logged into the Windows version of it. Like, how do we keep track of it? It's all confusing. But I kind of remember the argument they were giving, but it didn't sound like it was that big of a deal. There must be a reason though, because it's ridiculous that they haven't done it. I don't get it at all.
I guess it's conceivable that you can only log in from one place at a time. So if you logged in on your PC while your Xbox was logged in, it would cause a problem.
Even more so, just as a convenience for gamers, right. Which should be good enough reason to do it. It's actually a great thing for them because what it kind of reminds me of is like the magazines and the candy bars, the opportunity purchase things that they put at the checkout of the market. When you're going through and you don't think about picking up, Us Weekly or a Hershey bar or whatever, but you do because it's just in front of you and you're already buying a bunch of stuff, so you just throw it on there. If you're sitting at your computer, you may not be thinking about playing Left 4 Dead, as you say, but a little window pops up going, hey, some of your buddies are playing Left 4 Dead. Perhaps you'd like to join. And you go, I would.
Exactly.
And that's something you may not have made that decision on your own, but they're increasing the amount of time that you spend playing their games by opening up all the windows of opportunity to play them.
And thinking about games.
Yeah.
It makes you think about games when you otherwise would not have thought to have a pop-up saying, hey, Gaz is playing Left 4 Dead. Hey, I would like to, too. That is just mind-blowing that they don't have that. But,
And the system in Xbox, I actually don't know if this is something that they currently have in Games for Windows Live, but they certainly should have. Again, it amazes me that the same people who pioneered Xbox Live, which is probably the best online gaming system anywhere in the world in terms of all the functionality and the cleverness of it, that they haven't parlayed that into, you know, the guys that are sitting literally in the office next door trying to do the same thing. And they've got the technology, they've got the know-how, but, you know, you can be, you know, it's not just sitting at your desktop kind of looking at email when someone says, do you want to jump into this game? You can be playing another game. I could be playing Left 4 Dead, and a window will pop up that says such and such a person is playing Team Fortress 2. And I literally, all I have to do is press one button. Now, it's even more convenient on Windows, where everything's installed. Sometimes when I'm playing, I may be playing, say, Gears of War on my Xbox, and a thing will pop up saying such and such a person is playing Halo 3. Now, I may want to do that, but I still have to kind of get up off my ass and go swap the discs out. Yeah. But with everything installed these days on PC, it's literally a button click, and you're straight into the other game. It's this seamless switching from game to game. And so, again, that's just another thing that amazes me even more. It's actually even more useful on Windows. Right. And yet, it's not even, there's nothing even remotely like it.
Yeah, it's shocking. So so a few of the other things that I pointed out to them is that even now after a couple of updates, you know, it's got a fancy new interface that, you know, at least no longer looks exactly like the Xbox Live interface. But there's no new functionality, and there's less functionality than the Xbox has. There are no, like, for avatars, it gives you a handful of choices that you can pick from. For your icon, whereas the new Xbox experience guys have, you know, they can create their own little me like avatar, and on Steam you can pick any picture you want. You know, I have a picture of me on there. You know, or you can have a picture of somebody from StarCraft or whatever you want to put up there. You know, it's customization that it's just a little thing, but, you know, it kind of goes a long way. There's also no instant messenger style chat in Games for Windows. You can send like a kind of a clumsy little email thing, but it's no just quick back and forth. You can do a voice chat, but not everybody has a headset set up or has it on all the time. It's kind of annoying. It doesn't have any of the groups or scheduling stuff that Steam has. It doesn't even track like how many hours of a game you've been playing lately, like Steam does. Also, you know, when Games for Windows Live updates, like they've only updated like three times, but when they update, they force you to reboot your computer. I mean, that's just kind of insane, isn't it?
It's appalling.
Right.
It's depressing me talking about it, to be honest, because it's not, again, it's not like this requires any innovation. It's not like someone saying, oh, if only they could just figure out a way to do this. It's been figured out. Their Xbox division figured it out. Valve has figured it out. It's sitting there just waiting for a handful of guys to sit down and implement. And no one's doing it.
Yeah, I mean, they're you know, just kind of not even that far away from Valve's office. You know, they're geographically close as well, as, you know, it's just, and they're so far behind, and they have so many more resources that they could throw at this and just, you know, get it up to a good point where, I mean, maybe they could coast after a while, but right now it's just not finished. It's not competitive, and the gap between them and Steam and even Impulse and Xfire and kind of the smaller guys it's just getting bigger.
Maybe, you know, the reason, Dan, is simply that it's not a profit center for them the way Xbox is. People pay $50 a year to play Xbox Live, but it's free for Windows. So, you know, what's the incentive for them to put a bunch of money into developing this technology where there's no argument for, you know, how they make money back on it?
That's fair enough, but, you know, either put, be all in or all out. I mean, I don't see why they have to saddle games, you know, games otherwise good games with hampering technology like this.
They're just lazy. They've got senioritis because they know that in the home computer space there's no serious competition. In the console space, they've got serious competition on two sides, so they have to innovate and stay ahead all the time, and they've been very successful with that. In the home computer world, there's no one to compete with them. I guarantee you, if Apple were out there you know, encouraging developers to develop big exclusive games for them, and coming up with kind of all kinds of cool online gizmos for to facilitate online play, which you know they would do if they were if Apple bothered to get into this space, they'd probably be kicking Microsoft's ass right now with all kinds of clever ideas. But they're not doing it, and there's no sign they're going to. So Microsoft can just sit back and say whatever.
But aren't they arguably competing with Steam in this space? And they have
launched. What though? But for what are they competing with?
Well, they have just launched the Games for Windows Live Marketplace, which is also a total mess. They launched it with one piece of content, which was the Fallout DLC, the Operation Anchorage thing, which I mean, like this is like the first piece of content they offer up to PC gamers. And it's the only thing on there you can buy. You can also download a few demos and trailers and stuff like that. But this piece of DLC costs 800 Microsoft points. In order to get that, it makes you buy them in increments of 500. Now, yes, you can work around that. You can go to like the Zune Marketplace or whatever, and buy, you know, in smaller increments. But you know, not everybody has that. I mean, I just want to be able to buy this DLC. I don't want to pay for 1,000 points, which I don't even know how. Do you know how much that works out to, guys?
1,000 points is probably about a little under $15.
Right. So
that's the other thing. As I don't understand this, you know, Sony get a lot of grief, and rightly so, for a lot of the mistakes they've made with the PlayStation. But at least they're honest and upfront with what their products cost. You know, it's done in real dollars and cents. You want to buy a game or a demo, it's $3.99 or $9.99, and you put in exactly, you know, you say you want to buy it, and that amount is deducted from your credit card. You don't have to go through this ridiculous system of buying, you know, Disney dollars, right, which don't have any real value. Because I think the reason why they do it is they want to kind of obfuscate the real price of it. So you go, 1,000 Microsoft points, that doesn't sound too bad, but you don't realize you're actually paying $15, which is a real amount of money. It's the same way they give you chips at a casino. Because once you've converted that money into plastic chips, it doesn't seem like real money anymore. And so you're more likely to just, you know, kind of toss it away. And, you know, you don't realize until the next morning you've got no real money left. and also because, as you just said, they like the idea of, you know, like when you buy those Disney dollars, you know, whether or not you spend them, you can't ever change them back. You know, that, you know, whether you throw them away or whatever, they've already got your money. They don't care.
It's like a gift certificate. You have purchased $50 to Barnes & Noble, but there's never anything that costs exactly $50. It's always
$49. You know, the most pernicious example of it, and it's aimed directly at people like me who are lazy, is the mail-in rebate.
Right.
It's this whole idea of the hidden value of, you know, it's only $99.99, like $100 off after mail-in rebate. But they're relying on the fact that you're too lazy to jump through all the hoops, to cut out the UPC and sellotape it to a piece of paper and stuff it all in an envelope and wait 6 weeks to get your check. I don't know what the uptake is on mail-in rebates, but I bet you it's pretty low. And it's a completely false value that they create. And it's similar to what they do here, where, you know, they as soon as they've got your money, whether or not you redeem it for anything, they really don't care. They would prefer that you never redeemed it. Because, you know, they've already got the money, and if they don't have to deliver a service or any goods to you, that's a win-win for them.
Yeah, and you know, there's one other argument I've seen that makes it you know, beneficial to Microsoft, is it actually lowers the number of credit card transaction fees they have to pay, because, you know, if you're buying a series of 100 or 200 point items,
right,
they only have to pay one fee on it. Which
they're not paying fees for each product that you download, only for each time that you buy a chunk of points.
Exactly. And you know, that almost makes sense to me. It's like that sounds like a good, honest reason to do this, except A, they don't let you buy points in any increment you want over 500. You know, that's kind of ridiculous. And also, Valve and Impulse and Stardock and GOG.com and everybody else, they don't make you jump through that hoop. They're willing to take that hit. You know, it's just to improve the consumer experience. And Microsoft is not.
Yeah. And they couldn't do it, but they couldn't do it both ways, you see, because they know that if it was listed as real money, nobody would say, oh yeah, I'll just put $100 in my Microsoft account and who knows when I'll spend it.
Right.
You know, because you want the value for the money that you put in right away. But if you're just buying a bunch of points, then you feel like, oh yeah, that's in my account. But yeah, it's not. I hate the fact that I constantly have to do that. You know, where a game is say 1,200 points, and I have to kind of remember the bizarre equation, the bizarre currency conversion rate between real money and Microsoft points and back again.
Yeah, it's absurd. And you know, maybe on consoles they can kind of get away with that because they're the only place you can go to get certain games, or you know, on that platform, they're the only place you can go on that platform at all. But on PC,
as I said, Sony don't do it. Sony on the PlayStation 3, you pay, you know, you buy a product, you buy it like you would from Amazon. You pay $9.99 for that game. You don't have a standing balance. You only pay for what you want. So right. I don't know why it's so difficult for Microsoft.
Right. But and on the PC, it's like I have that option and I have several other options to get you know, similar or the same content. The Fallout DLC is the only thing they've got lined up right now, which is, and they don't even have stuff that other people have. You know, it's goofy.
The other area where I think they'll meet resistance on this is that PC gamers just aren't accustomed to paying for DLC the way that console owners have been from the beginning. You know, as soon as consoles went online and you could start downloading content for your console from a server. Pretty much anything of any significance, be it a mini game or an add-on DLC or you know like tracks for Rock Band or Guitar Hero, they've all had a price attached. So people don't have a sense of entitlement towards free stuff. But you know, a lot of PC gamers, especially the ones that have been around for a while, you know, remember when you used to be able to get stuff for free. So you know, they suddenly start putting price stickers on it. People don't like that.
Yeah, and I mean Bethesda did it with Oblivion. They had some paid DLC on the PC.
Yeah, but do you remember there was a big scandal about that? They wanted to charge you a couple of bucks for a horse, and people
were
up
armor,
in arms
yeah.
about it. It was yeah. a big outrage.
Yeah, and I think they learned from that they're not going to put out just you know single items like that anymore. I think they learned their lesson, and now they're putting out bigger chunks that actually justify a price tag. Although I gotta say, after having played through Operation Anchorage just last night, I don't know if it's worth that, you know, more than a couple bucks.
How much are they charging for it?
It's 800 points. You tell me.
So 800 points is about.
I think it's $10.
About $10.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if I don't think it's quite worth $10. It's an interesting diversion from the main game. It plays very differently because it's trying to be more of a shooter and less of an RPG.
How long is it?
It probably took me 2 hours, maybe a little longer.
I tell you what's creating this difficulty for companies like Bethesda and for Microsoft that want to try and establish a pay model is Valve, which continues to give away commercial content that's actually worth something, and they probably could charge whatever they want to. They're giving it away for free, and they're messing up everyone else's game.
and they have just managed to force Microsoft's hand to allow them to release it for free on Xbox, which was shocking to everybody who always thought that Microsoft was going to make everybody charge for everything on there.
Well, it is shocking because Microsoft have been very militant and sticking to their guns about this notion that you know, they want their content to have value and they want to make money. And so if a third-party company wants to put something on their server, DLC or whatever, I think this happened recently with Gears of War or Gears of War 2. They got into a thing with Epic where Epic wanted to give it away for free, and Microsoft said, no, you've got to charge for it. Valve may have a little bit more clout. I don't know. Left 4 Dead certainly was a big hit on Xbox 360. It's a very popular game right now on Xbox Live. Valve is probably able to, you know, face Microsoft down a little bit and say this is the way that we want to do it. But I admire them immensely for that because I'm not surprised at all that their DLC is free on PC because it's always been that way. But to do it on Xbox is fantastic because it breaks precedent and sets a new one, which is probably a little bit worrying for Microsoft because people are going to be going onto Xbox now and saying, well, look, all this great content is free. Why am I paying for this content, which is of a certain quality, but I don't have to pay for this, which is every bit as good. It's going to start messing with people's expectations.
And Valve is really kind of turning themselves almost into like a Robin Hood-esque developer here. That they're giving to the poor almost, or you know, the poor that have bought their game. but I mean, it's really strengthening their brand, I think, to tell people, hey, we're going to stand up to be able to give you guys more stuff, more value for the price that you initially paid. We're not just going to, you know, put this thing out in the wild and then, you know, maybe continually try and make a buck off it or just leave it to rot.
I don't think they're necessarily, you know, that Valve is this company that's full of incredibly generous, altruistic yeah. people. I think they recognize it as a smart business model. They make a lot of money off Steam and the games that they sell. All their games are big successes. They're swimming in money up there in wherever
Bellevue.
It is.
They're in Bellevue, Washington.
I was just there recently. I can't remember that. But, you know, they're doing very, very well. And they understand, look, we've got all this money. Rather than, you know, try to hold on to and grasp every single penny of it that we can, let's put a little bit back into developing a little bit extra free content that basically just increases customer loyalty and appreciation of our brand. That's why Valve is such a well-liked company, not just because their games are so good, but because they are perceived to treat their customers so well. Compare that to a company like Microsoft.
Yeah, they really do see customer loyalty as a strategy, as opposed to, you know, trying to squeeze a dime out in the short term.
It's
kudos for them. Yeah. So just to wrap this up, the other quick things I had to complain about for Microsoft was. Actually, Rock Paper Shotgun put up a story that was pretty close to my experience getting the Fallout 3 DLC. If you go there and search for Adventures in GFWL, you'll find it. It details their hassle of getting it to actually work and you know getting it to actually accept their credit card information and then getting it to actually download correctly and you know going through a reboot for the marketplace update and a bunch of other hoops to jump through that were really obnoxious, and there was one problem that you know this is probably equal fault Bethesda and Microsoft, but because I did not have Fallout 3 installed on my C drive, it did not work. I was running around in the game for because it kind of indicated to me that it was installed, but I was running around in the game for probably 10 hours looking for this radio transmission that tells me where to go. To play this extra part, and it never came. So eventually, I pinged Bethesda and asked them, you know, what's going on here, and it was a problem because it was stored in a certain area, it didn't quite work right, and yeah, it was that's probably their you know equal parts Microsoft and Bethesda's fault, but yeah, it's not a good way to launch that marketplace service, and. Also, you know, just to finish out my list here, being that there are only 15 games that support games for Windows Live, and most of them are old news now, there's really not that much of a community there. I don't go on there to update my friends list, right, my buddy list. There aren't a lot of people I play with on there because all the games they're playing are elsewhere. So, and Microsoft is really not helping that because in 2008 they didn't put out a single PC game. And they only have one PC game slated for in the next year or two, which is Alan Wake, and that will be single player only, so it won't even have me going on there to play that. It's really frustrating that they go around saying that they're going to treat the PC as a top tier gaming platform. They've said this multiple times, a top tier gaming platform that they don't want to touch. They don't want to put anything on it. That
is so ridiculous, though. And again, you look at the console world for an example of how the business model should probably be working. On every console format, an integral part of the system's success and a big part of the way in which it's judged is how well it's supported by the first party. Right. You know, Microsoft obviously put a huge amount of effort into developing titles like Halo, you know, as brand champions for the Xbox. Sony has done the same thing with games like Resistance and Killzone. Nintendo, obviously, if it wasn't for Nintendo's own games, they wouldn't be in the business. Mario and Zelda and everything. I mean, that is Nintendo. It's their own games. They're clearly the strongest thing in that company's history. And yet Microsoft, when you switch over to the computer side, it's almost as though a flip is switched and the same rules don't apply anymore. If they want to treat it like a platform, treat it like a platform. Treat it like the way they do the Xbox and develop homegrown first-party titles that act as you know, standard bearers for the platform.
Right, and I spoke to Chris Early, the former manager for the Games for Windows program, on a couple days ago. But he had just been laid off from Microsoft in their first ever layoffs at the company. And that interview, by the way, will appear in our May issue of the magazine. But just a quick thing from that was he said that Microsoft thinks when they say that they're thinking of something different. They're thinking, you know, we're going to make Windows a great platform for other people to develop on. They're going to, you know, keep developing DirectX, for example. They don't think of it as actually producing games, which to me it's like they have like somebody you don't entirely trust coming up to you and saying, here, have this drink, you know, drink this, I made it, it's awesome. And then you say, well, you know, are you going to drink some? And they say, oh God, no. But here, try it, it's great. It's like, what, did you spit in it? Is that what's going on here? It really makes you wonder what they're thinking.
It's insane. And again, you know, look at the Xbox as an example. When they launched the Xbox, they created Halo as a killer app for it. You can't release a platform, be it Windows or a hardware platform like a console, and say, well, we're just going to leave it up to everyone else to ensure that it's success. You have to take some responsibility. I think you have to take a leading role in being responsible for the success of your own platform. And when almost all of that success is defined by the games that are released on it, you've got to lead by example. Show other developers and show consumers the kind of games that are possible uniquely on your platform, and encourage other developers to follow your example. I think that the Xbox ultimately probably would have been successful without Halo, but I don't think it would have been as successful as it is today without Microsoft leading the way and saying, look, this is what our system can do. Now the ball's in your court. You can't just put a system out and say, right, well, you know, we hope someone makes some good games for it. You got to get off your ass and make your own ones.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a sad situation. I really hope that they actually take my suggestions back to Microsoft and hopefully, you know, make a convincing case. I doubt that my suggestions will encourage them to actually make games for Windows. Maybe just make the service not suck quite so bad. Now I will say that in Dawn of War it works pretty well because it's kind of obfuscated by Relic's own system that kind of covers it up, and it's just kind of running the back end. It's running like the matchmaking stuff, and the multiplayer matching basically, and that it does pretty well. I did ask Relic. I think I've said this on the podcast before, but I asked them why they chose to use Games for Windows Live when they're also requiring that you install Steam to activate the game. And their response was that Steam at least at the time when they were trying to do that did not have a good peer-to-peer multiplayer infrastructure, and they needed something that all of Valve stuff is server based, so there's a server running, you connect to it, but I wouldn't be able to host a game of Team Fortress 2 on my PC and to say host game and everybody connects to me, and that's what they were looking for with Dawn of War. So once Valve gets that up and running, then maybe fewer people will use this service. But it does work pretty well on Dawn of War. You know, I had no problem setting up multiplayer games. I've been in the beta playing multiplayer games. It works well. Don't let that scare you away from Dawn of War 2. Speaking of Dawn of War 2, it is now turned up on GameStop after being conspicuously absent. You can now pre-order it on GameStop.com or in the store. I haven't been able to get THQ to explain why that is, but I suspect, we had a theory going earlier that GameStop was trying to discourage people from using Steam as their activation because in doing so, GameStop would be selling a product that you install on your computer and then Steam pops up and says, hey, you can buy games here. And they probably don't like that very much, which would explain why for a while Dawn of War 2 was not on their site, why the other two games that had been out up until, I guess, Fear 2 does as well now, but Saints Row 2 and 2K's 2K09 NBA game, those were the other two games that had been out that used Steam as activation. Those were not available. The PC versions were not available on GameStop's site either. Now Saints Row 2 is up on there, but so they may work something out. But I suspect
I can kind of see the reasoning behind it. If I was the CEO of GameStop, I might make that decision. You know, they right. clearly see the times they are a changing, and they're right. under threat from companies like Steam and PSN Online and Xbox Live and, you know, Games for Windows Marketplace and these other companies. They know that it's an inevitability that their bricks and mortar businesses are going to go out. Companies like Blockbuster and companies like GameStop, you know, that sell media are going to go out of business in their current form. And so, as inevitable though it is, I guess you've still got to make whatever competitive business choices you can to try and stave that off for as long as possible.
But they don't seem to have stuck to it. They seem to have realized that's kind of a bad idea. Because, I mean, all they're doing in that case is telling people that are interested in that game, go somewhere else. They're kind of shutting that business off to them. It's not going to stop people from getting that game. It's not going to stop people.
You're
from
kind of stuck
Steam.
Between a rock and a hard place, aren't you? You either play into the hands of your competitor, or play into the hands of another of your competitors.
Right.
It's you can't really win.
But I think that the fact that they put it back up may have something to do with, if you go to the GameStop site and look at the bonus offer they've got with it, which includes an exclusive Chapter Command War Gear set, which War Gear is basically loot that you pick up. The single-player game is very RPG-like, kind of an action RPG almost. So they have like exclusive loot that you can get in if you buy it from GameStop, either online or in the store. And it also has like 8 exclusive metallic colors that you can use to customize your units. And in multiplayer, you can kind of paint your units in very Warhammer-esque style, or, you know, and on the tabletop game, they people like to paint their units in specific army colors, you know, unique to them. So the game lets you do something similar, and this gives you 8 additional colors you can use. I suspect that was probably offered to them as an incentive to put it back up. I'm actually not certain that it wasn't up the first time they had it up before they pulled it down, but I would be surprised. So they seem to have come to their senses, at least in terms of offering games that use Steam, which is good because Steam is a much less obtrusive DRM solution than like what EA had been using. So we're encouraged to see that. Finally, we've got a few announcements that have come out. Alien vs. Predator 3 is in development. Sega is publishing, and it's being developed by the original developer of Alien vs. Predator, Rebellion, which is a UK developer. There's not really any information out on it, just that it exists. And it like Sega also just announced some layoffs, so they're feeling the pinch just like everybody else. Which has led to some speculation that the other two Alien games might be in jeopardy. There's Alien Colonial Marines, and then an unconfirmed game that may or may not be in development somewhere else. They kind of alluded to a third Alien game in the press release about this, but Alien Colonial Marines has been pushed back until 2010. It was initially slated for release this year. That's in development at Gearbox, but I don't know. I'm excited for an Alien vs. Predator 3. It was a great. The first two were really great games. At least I love being able to play as the alien.
Did you guys have a lot of information on Alien Colonial Marines at all?
Not a whole lot. I mean, there were some early previews, but the fact that it's being pushed back so far kind of makes you wonder if any of that information is applicable anymore. They may have taken it back and reworked it.
Was there any indication in the multiplayer that you could play as the alien?
No. Oh,
okay.
It's kind of a co-op, almost Left 4 Dead style thing.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because I mean, the compelling thing about AVP 2 and the first one was that you would actually play as the alien or the predator.
Playing as the predator was okay. I don't think it was nearly as fun as playing as the alien.
Because
the alien was such a different. It was kind of like in Left 4 Dead, where we've got the you've got the zombies as a totally different mode of playing compared to playing as the humans. I mean, they can climb up walls that the humans can't climb up. They can they have special abilities that humans don't have that make them play totally different. And the aliens did that. I mean, they let you crawl up walls and actually like go upside down on the ceilings and drop down on people. They had in the multiplayer they allowed you to start as a face hugger and pounce on people. And
that was such a good mode.
Yeah, and you know it was great. It was a great gameplay mode. So hopefully the new one will live up to the past ones. And it's encouraging that they've given it back to the original developer. The other couple of bits of news is Square Enix, who
they bought Eidos, right?
They've put in a bid to buy Eidos.
So that's not confirmed 100% yet?
No, they're trying to buy it.
Oh, I see.
There may be other bids. I mean, Warner Brothers has a significant stake in Eidos, so we'll have to see how that goes down. But it will be, you know, very interesting to see if they really want to get into. It's obviously they really want to get into the kind of a more Western development. I mean, they've already announced they're publishing Supreme Commander 2, which is, you know, published out of it's gas powered games game. It's out of Seattle.
I was going to ask, when you buy Eidos, what exactly are you getting?
You're getting
Tomb Raider, right? But what else?
You get Kane and Lynch.
You're getting Hitman. What else do they get?
They're going to have to really like manly up their ident in the front of the game.
They've done a decent job of keeping the Tomb Raider concept viable. To be honest with you, I'm long in the tooth enough to remember when the first Tomb Raider game first came out. I think I actually reviewed it for PC Gamer way back in the day. The first Tomb Raider, and it was a great game. And you know, deserved all the success it got, but it was kind of like that, you know, the goose that laid the golden egg thing, where Eidos were like, oh my god, we finally got a huge franchisable hit with a breakout character, and they just milked it to death. You know, 2 and 3 came out very, very quickly, and by 3 you could tell, you know, they're spreading themselves too thin here, and they're going to dilute the power of this brand by trying to squeeze every last nickel out of it. And then, you know, more and more Tomb Raider games came, and it got to the point where they had to kind of take a break and reboot it recently, which I think they did with some success. They've started to bring the Tomb Raider games back.
Right. They gave it to a new developer. They gave it to Crystal Dynamics, who have done a great job with it. The last few have done really well with us. Logan loves the hell out of them. And they did a good job of you know, they came out with a new engine, reinvigorated the franchise quite a bit. I guess Eidos was disappointed in the most recent sales of Tomb Raider Underworld. I guess it sold about half as well as the previous one, but still, you know, sold like 1.5 million on consoles at least.
It was a cautionary tale, though. I mean, Eidos was, and I think to some extent still is, a company that's not very highly regarded. You know, they put out a lot of B and C titles. You know, I don't really understand what their brand values are. They're just a company that makes games, and they had struggled by for a while, and then when they kind of lucked into Tomb Raider, I think they were so smitten by that success that they got a little drunk on it. And it's, you know, it just goes to show. I remember it happened on TV as well with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire when ABC started showing that show. And it was so popular, they put it on every night of the week, and people got sick of it really quickly because it was too much. And so I think ultimately they did the right thing with Tomb Raider. It's kind of the same thing that they have to do with Star Trek every now and again. You know, it kind of runs its course. People get tired of it. It's creatively exhausted, so they just have to let it sit for a while and let people's interest kind of just naturally regenerate before they can bring it back.
Right. Oh, you know what? What else they have is Deus Ex. They are working on Deus Ex.
Oh, that's right. Deus Ex 3.
Is any of the original people involved in that?
I don't think so. But you know, it could still be good.
Is that going to come out on consoles as well?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But I think it's
lead console, right?
Probably
most likely.
It's doomed. Doomed.
Man, I was watching. It's so funny. I was watching some. I can't remember what message board I was on recently, but there was a thread of like bad cinematics from games, and I was watching some. I don't remember the original Deus Ex. I never really played it. And I was watching these cinematics of the lead character, and I mean, I understand the technology has you know come on a lot since then. It's easy to laugh at these games. That could look kind of lame now, but my God, the cinematics were so bad. You know, the characters just looked like really bad puppets, and the dialogue was awful. And I remember at the time it was being heralded as like this big step forward in, you know, in-game cinematic storytelling. But to look at it now, it's just a joke.
You know what other kind of you know, awful things that IDOS puts out is a game on based on Death Junior.
Oh, they do Death Junior?
Yeah, that was one of yours, wasn't it?
Well, I never worked on the games. All I wrote the comic book spin-off. That was as much as my involvement was. But that was at Konami. I didn't realize that IDOS had subsequently picked it up.
Yeah, apparently they did the Wii game.
Oh, well, there you go.
Death Junior, Root of Evil.
Yeah, I always felt like the Wii was probably the best format for it because, you know, you're swinging that scythe around. It always seemed like that would be a good... And, it's a game that's really for kids. So I always felt like the Wii is probably where I would find a home.
Right. But the other interesting publisher news of the day is that Midway has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Which does not mean they're going away. The Chapter 11 is a reorganizational thing. I never really understand exactly how this works. It's a company saying, hey, we have no money, but we're going to keep going anyway. I guess there's some kind of restructuring going on. I'm not an accountant, not a bankruptcy lawyer, so I have no idea how that works. But apparently they're going to keep right on trucking. They still have a couple of games. They've got this.
Well, that's
Vegas,
and again, what do they have? I mean, didn't they just put out a Mortal Kombat game, right? I was actually intrigued by the Mortal Kombat game they put out recently because it was like Mortal Kombat versus
DC
characters,
right?
And I thought that was kind of interesting way to try and breathe some life into it. But yeah, what do they have? They have a Vin Diesel game coming out, right?
Driver, yeah.
The Wheelman.
Wheelman, that's right. Yeah. So those are the two games I know of that they have in development at Midway is Wheelman and This Is Vegas. So those you know are supposedly still happening. So
no one's always surprised by this news though, are they? It's like the death watch for Midway's been going on for a while now.
Yeah, they've been in trouble for a while. They I guess Sumner Redstone, the owner of Viacom, was like the majority shareholder, and he sold off like the majority of shares for like $100,000. Just to unload it. So it's
I mean,
not
the Mortal Kombat brand alone, you like to think has got to be worth something, right?
Yeah, you would think. And they used to publish the Unreal games, but I guess the last one went to Atari. All right, so that'll do it for our news of the day. Should we take a couple questions?
Looking at recent and upcoming releases, I was wondering if anyone at PC Gamer is in agreement with me that the gaming world's opinion of Crysis was horribly underrated. Before Far Cry 2 came out, it was heralded as the game that would finally show Crysis graphics and technology without sacrificing performance. It is beautiful in its own right and quite a bit of fun, but the AI is incredibly lacking. The physics are a joke with pre-canned model swaps and other bits of tech and gameplay just don't hold a candle to what Crysis did a year before. Now many are raving about Killzone 2, some trying to compare it to Crysis, when those who've played both know that Crysis is so much more than just impressive visuals. It just seems to me that people got so swept up into talk about sales, performance, console ports, and piracy that no one gave it a fair analysis after initial reviews. Sales talk in particular is a funny subject now that Crytek has been so successful that they could purchase the console-exclusive developer Free Radical. Anyway, all that said, does anyone there agree? And while we're at it, any idea when we can find out some more news about future Crytek games? Thanks.
Well, I think we certainly gave Crysis a fair shake. It's one of our...
More than.
In some people's opinion. Right?
I kind of couldn't agree more with this guy. I mean, I find that I keep referencing Crysis as the bar that's been set as far as first-person shooter immersive experience, especially having been going through Far Cry 2 just recently and not being impressed at all. And I think Crysis is just – I think it's pushed the bar like a little bit farther than people tend to like think about because it's not on the consoles, and so people don't even consider it a game when usually you know a lot of the press don't talk about it because it's not on consoles. So – yeah, I agree. Crysis is still an amazing experience, and not just visually, but just the way it plays. So,
I think it was a victim of overhyping.
I think
it is a fantastic game, but people expected it to absolutely change everything about the game, about how they experience games, and it was a great evolutionary step forward, I think, in terms of both graphics and I still think the AI is great, even though there are glitches. There are always glitches in AI.
There's something to be said about
immersion. Don't you take some responsibility for that overhyping?
Well, I mean, not any more than any other game. I mean, that's kind of what we do, is we showcase the new big thing and say, hey, this looks great. And we were right, it was great.
Right, but you're saying that this game was overhyped.
Yeah,
you're saying it was hyped beyond what was appropriate for what the game ultimately was.
Right, but I don't think that our particular coverage said that it was going to be anything more than it was. I don't have it all off the top of my head, but I don't think we ever made any grandiose claims that it was going to absolutely revolutionize anything. We said it looked fantastic. We said that it had great gameplay, both of which are true. But I think EA's marketing may have been a little bit over the top, and it's easy for people to get carried away with that. I mean, even when the marketing is being realistic, it's easy to for us and for gamers out there to see something and just think it's going to be so incredibly awesome that it can never possibly live up to those expectations.
There's a lot of gamers too who ragged on it though, for not being something that they enjoyed as much as maybe I did or Chuck did, for example, But I've yet to play a first person shooter that grabs me and shakes me and holds me like Crysis does. So yeah, where are they? I agree. Where it at?
Fear 2?
You're not it either, so I don't know.
What is
going to be the next great first person shooter?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't think we know yet what it's
Metro, the Russian game.
Yeah, Metro. It could be a lot better than Stalker was, or Doom 4 is under development.
When you did the top 9 of 2009, what was in there? Was there any first person shooters in there?
There was Deus Ex. There was what else is in there? I have to grab that issue. I don't. Oh shit.
When's its next game coming out?
Its next game may very well be Doom 4, so it'll be a ways off.
Really, not the what's the other one?
Rage thing.
Rage. Yeah.
Yeah, that one that they're not really talking about right now. So I think it'll be next year at the earliest.
Fear 2 was
the Valve's got nothing on the horizon, right? There's no new Half-Life coming.
No, well, I mean they've got to do something on Episode 3 sometime soon, and then Portal 2 is a foregone conclusion. That's got to come sooner rather than later, you would think. They'll probably make some announcements this year.
It is cool to hear about how Crytek has exploded as a studio, though. They have an empire now.
Right, they're building way up. How badly could Crysis have done if they are still buying
stuff up? Are they licensing their engine?
Yes, they are.
God, but Warhead, yeah.
There is one game that's coming out in March, I believe. It's an episodic game using the Crytek engine. What's it called? It's like the Merchant of something. Let me look up that name. Merchants of Brooklyn is the episodic game coming out using the Crytek engine.
Because that's good business these days. I mean, companies like id and Epic, could probably stop making games altogether if they decided they wanted to and just live off their engine licenses.
Right. Right. And aside from Gears of War, that's kind of what Epic does these days. So let's take another question.
Hey guys, it's Josh from Northern New Jersey. I'm just trying to call in. I'm a first-time caller. My question to you is, I just got my new PC maybe a year ago, and I love it. I spent more than anything on it. So my question to you is, I'm really trying to get into strategy gaming, and it may seem a little intimidating to a lot of people, but I really want to go for it. I know it takes a lot of time and stuff like that. I play the Battle for Middle-earth too, and I like it a lot. I'm really trying to get into that realm again. And that's my question to you. What do you suggest is good for me to start with? Okay, I have to go now because I'm late for work. All right, can't wait to hear my question on your podcast. Later. Bye.
Now, if we'd have got this question years ago when I was editor at PC Gamer in the 90s, my first answer would have been, well, what kind of strategy are you talking about? Do you like real-time strategy or do you like turn-based strategy? But these days, of course, the old-fashioned turn-based Grognard games are pretty much dead, right? So it's just a question of what's the best real-time strategy game.
And there's still the Civ series for turn-based. And
yeah, but even that makes a lot of concessions to real-time.
Does it?
I think so.
They added a few RTS conventions to the interface, like being able to group select things. But outside of that, no, not really.
But I'm talking about like the old classic Panzer General type things. You know, you don't see those anymore. The ones where you really sit and consider your next move. Everything's fast now.
True.
So I don't know what is considered the current flagship in the RTS genre.
Our strategy game of the year for last year was Zins of the Solar Empire, which I still think is brilliant. The expansion for that, which is called Entrenchment, it beefs up the defenses. It just got pushed back until February 25th. It was going to be out yesterday initially, but then they pushed it back a little bit to incorporate a little bit more beta feedback, which is great. You know, they're pumping it up for, you know, making it more what people want. But yeah, I recommend that one.
I would definitely recommend Red Alert 3 too, because I haven't been playing strategy games for probably like 3 years. I've just kind of been out of it, but I jumped right back in with Red Alert 3 and just playing co-op. I've been playing with Evan a lot. We went through the whole Japanese campaign as someone who's getting back into the strategy genre too. It's really nice to play co-op with someone who knows their stuff. So you kind of have a buddy there helping you along if you're trying to get your feet wet still.
Gaz, are you playing?
I just started playing Command & Conquer 3. Red Alert 3. Because I was a huge fan of the first two. Probably even more so than the core CNC games. I loved the Red Alert games. I loved the mythology. It just felt a lot more grounded. Even though it was sci-fi, it just felt a lot more real. I mean, we used to play Red Alert 2. We played the hell out of that in the PC Gamer offices back in the day. And so I was keen to see Red Alert 3. I was waiting for it to come out on Steam. It did recently, so I got it. I've really just started with the tutorials and the campaign. I'm going back to basics, but whether or not the deep strategy is there or how balanced it is, I don't know. But one thing I do know where it didn't disappoint is the production values on it are just insane. I mean, the quality of the cinematics and the in-game graphics and the voice work and everything. I mean, they really went nuts. It's by far the most richly appointed strategy game I've ever played.
They really revel in the cheesiness. It's really really kind of it's a selling point. How cheesy it is. You know, it's kind of some groaning lines, but they're doing it while they're winking at you.
And I mean, and they know that. I mean, I think the first live action character you see in the very opening cinematic is Tim Curry.
Right.
And as soon as you see him, you know, okay, well, I know that I don't have to take this too seriously. And, right. You know, and Peter Stormare is there kind of camping it up, doing crazy stuff. And, you know, it's all very just fun, you know.
You can't forget George Takei.
Seriously.
You can't forget about George Takei there.
George Takei and, you know, a bunch of other actors slumming it, you know, having fun on the green screen stage. And, you know, and even in the game, you know, I was just playing the tutorial and the three enemy tanks, you know, one for each faction that are kind of guiding you through the tutorial there's a lot of banter between them and they're just, you know, it's just a lot of fun. But whether or not it holds up strategically, I've always felt that this is the one kind of genre that I would never want to design other than an MMO is a real-time strategy game, because the balancing is such a precise thing. You know, you tip it ever so slightly one way or this way, and it destabilizes the whole game, especially when experienced players get in there. And this is why they can't just release the game and let it go. They've got to constantly be watching what's happening online, what players are what strategies people are using, and constantly, you know, going in and tinkering unit values and strengths and other options to keep the game fair and to keep players on their toes.
Right,
very, very challenging genre design.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to even comment on whether or not it's balanced. especially at launch, because I, almost by definition, it's not perfectly balanced. But you know, whether people are going to discover that right away and you know, figure out how long it's going to take them to figure out how to exploit any problems in the balance. You know, like if something is wildly unbalanced, then we'll catch it in the review and be able to say so. But generally, especially the games from the bigger guys, they're polished well enough after a public beta that you can, they're going to be pretty well balanced. And even if they're not, they'll patch it. You know, so I mean, with Red Alert 3, strategically it is very, very fast, but. And also it is very micromanagement hungry. Like every unit has two functions. It has a regular attack and then a secondary attack or function, or, you know, ability. So in order to get the most out of your units, you really have to tinker with them, but you can also just tell them to attack move and you know, they'll do their thing. So yeah.
You're probably the most competent RTS player I know, Dan. Like you're the most elite strategy player that I know. Like,
even I'm not that great, but yeah.
What do I know? But since you're the best I've got, you know, available to me right now. So right. Like when you get into the upper echelons, like these pro players and people that really are good with all their macros and stuff, are they micromanagers, or are they people that know kind of how to get the results that they want with the minimum of key presses and stuff?
They're absolutely micromanagers. There's never like even a fraction of a second really when they're not doing something. They're not tweaking something to get maximum efficiency out of it. So it's a little of both. They are both you know, figuring out the most efficient build orders, the most efficient ways to get every last resource out and how to, like, exactly when to build what, and also they're finding the time to manipulate their units and use their special abilities and put them exactly where they want them. It's really an amazing skill.
It becomes a speed game. The analogy that I've used before is the difference between, you know, you and me playing ping pong and watching the way that, you know, like Korean Olympic champions play it. You know, it's not even the same. It's not like the same game sped up. It's just not even. It's not the same game at all. Right. And you know, and I've noticed that I've had a lot of fun. You know, I've been to a couple of BlizzCons and watched those the Korean guys playing StarCraft at speed, which is just I can't even comprehend just watching it, let alone be the guy controlling that stuff. And right. I'll be in a game of Command and Conquer or whatever against, you know, a fairly decent player. And I'll be there toodling around going, do, 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 do. Oh, where shall I put my barracks? I think I'll put it over here. And by the time I've done that, the guy's got 50 tanks rolling towards me.
Yep.
You know, and sometimes the only way to understand it is to go into spectator mode and watch people play. And you're right, there isn't a wasted second. You know, you never see them just idling. There's always something for them to do. And I think it takes a specific kind of mind to be able to juggle priorities and to be able to understand here is the absolute most efficient way to use every millisecond of my time to maximize everything that I can possibly do. I just don't think my brain is wired that way.
Yeah, I don't think mine is either. These guys are incredible multitaskers, and I mean for me playing at that speed, and you know, people always like to jump on me for saying this, but I keep saying it anyway because it's fun. But I like to create controversy. For me, I think that the amount of strategy that's actually going into it, what I think of as strategy that goes into playing a game, decreases in relation to how the speed increases. It's an inverse relationship. Just because, you know, when I think of strategy, like ultimately I think of chess. You know, chess is like the ultimate strategy game, and like the amount of thought that goes into each move, you know, decreases as you speed up the clock. So in speed chess is less strategic than regular chess because it is faster. I'm not saying there is no strategy in this. I think of it like almost a sport in that there's strategy on the basketball court. You're gonna you know, push you know, to one side or the other based on the weaknesses of the other team, the strengths of yours, which is kind of the same thing. But that's strategy. But basketball is not a strategy game. It's a game about speed and skill and agility. You know, so it's when I say that there's less strategy, I'm not saying that there's no skill. I'm saying that it's not what I think of as strategy. And that's why like I never really wanted to compete at that level. I never put the time into to to hone my routines and everything on one particular game to that level, because to me that's just not all that rewarding.
You know what I think is also going on at that level of the game, at that highest level? It's like something I learned about. I'm not really a football fan, but something I learned about NFL football recently is that whatever team you're facing or whatever, the first 20 plays or whatever it is are locked in. Like, you always know what your opening plays are going to be, and then depending on how the game is going, you adapt and you swap out different plays and different strategies. And I think it's the same thing with RTS. You know, at the top level, you know what you want to do. You know that you're going to build this first and that, and you're going to get this moving. You're going to go establish the second base. You're going to pump out these kind of units, these kind of defenses, and there's a certain playbook that you don't deviate from. And then as you start to see what your enemy is doing and how he's playing the game, you begin to adapt your strategy around that.
Absolutely, and yeah, that's the kind of strategy that they use in like high levels RTS games. You're absolutely right. So it's calling from a playbook and less thinking on the fly. And you know, arguably that you see the same thing in chess. There are known defenses and offensives, but
different chess openings. There's the same equivalent in RTS.
Right.
I used to put all my eggs in one basket. Like, I used to be a tank rusher. Back when tank rushing was still viable, used to build a lot of tanks in Red Alert 2. But you know, because the other opponent, and a lot of times I'd either do an engineer rush where you get one engineer in and just disable all his, just destroy everything before he can get to him, or you do a tank rush. But you commit to that strategy. You know, you have to put all your resources into building a couple of bases and building a bunch of tanks, and you send them in. And if the guy has anticipated that and wipes out your tank rush with his defenses, you've got nothing left, because he's now built a base and you've committed all your resources that have been destroyed. So it can be a big risk. I think that's why, again, top level players won't do anything that risky. You know, they'll go through their playbook, they'll solidify their base, and then meet you on their own terms.
Well, recon is very important in RTS games, because you have to scout out the other guy to see if he is doing something like that. If I scout you out early on and I see that you are doing a tank rush, I concentrate on anti-tank weapons, and you're screwed.
Right.
So like recon is very important, and like in a game like Supreme Commander, there's like so many recon options that you have to and so much of a big playing field, and also there are like counterintelligence weapons like cloaking devices and radar jammers and like things that send false radar signals out to make your enemy think that you have a large force where you don't. That in that game, I think the intelligence gathering game is a lot stronger than most. I should also just toss out Supreme Commander, or not Supreme Commander, Company of Heroes as an excellent RTS game if you're looking to get one. And of course, Dawn of War. Let's do playlists pretty quick. Josh, what have you been playing?
Well, besides Red Alert 3 co-op with Evan, I've been playing WoW. I've been trying a bunch of different MMOs, Runes of Magic, Lunia. I've also been playing a lot of Audio Surf, just having fun with that, doing like Dropkick Murphys, Red Hot Chili Peppers. I tried pushing the limits. I tried some Simon and Garfunkel and some musicals, but those did not play so well.
You don't like Simon and Garfunkel?
No, I love Simon and Garfunkel. It just doesn't play as well on Audio Surf. Yeah, right. It just goes really, really slow.
Right. Now, with those MMOs you said you were trying out, are there any standouts? Any ones you liked?
Runes of Magic is a lot of fun. Lunia is interesting just because it's like it calls itself an arcade action MMO, I think. And so you kind of have like combo moves where you hit like, okay, 1-1-3 up, and then like your character will do a unique move. So there is some pretty interesting stuff.
Well, there was some of that kind of thing in Conan, wasn't there? Where there would be kind of combos that you would use, like things would light up after you've done a couple of attacks in order. I think there was something like that. I didn't play it very much.
I honestly did not play it at all, but I did hear something like that.
Right. I'm also interested to see like Champions Online, how that's that one's also kind of an action game. I'll be interested to see how they spice up the combat, if they're going to be adding in combos and things like that.
Yeah,
that one's coming out pretty soon actually, so we'll be on the lookout for it. Andy Bauman, what are you playing?
I've been playing some more Far Cry 2, trying to get into it more, and I don't know. I just can't seem to immerse myself enough to lose my over consciousness and just play it for hours on end. There's just something about how you have to drive everywhere or take a boat, which is even harder than driving as far as the enemies attacking you, because the gun turrets on the boats only go 45 degrees, whereas the gun turrets on the cars at least go 360 degrees. And you're always constantly being stopped and forced to either shoot your enemies, you know, or repair your Jeep. And it just seems like it's the same sort of dumb, I don't know if that's the right word, but sort of, I don't know, not interesting, yeah, repetitious missions, where when you actually are in the midst of the mission, I can see the game having flashes of fun, and it's actually an interesting how to, like, strategize what you're going to do when you're actually, you know, in the midst of it. But all the travel time and all the ambushing and stopping and repairing, it's just too much, and it's not compelling enough of an open world thing, emergent gameplay. Like, I don't know, these words just don't happen in Far Cry 2, and I think it's a rare case where the gaming press loved it and the users aren't so impressed. I don't know.
Oh, I think there are probably quite a few users. In fact, I've heard from several gamers that I'm friends with that enjoy it thoroughly.
That's true. I know of a couple too, and I'm just like, okay, I don't understand it as much, I guess. But
to be fair though, Andy, I think there are a lot of people that you just got off saying how much you love Crysis.
Yeah, but true.
A lot of people that feel the exact same way about Far Cry 2, or opposite way about Far Cry 2, I think.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I don't know. Far Cry 2, I might just put away. So, yeah.
Right. I only played like half an hour of that so far. I need to get back in and give it some more time. It kind of came out during the glut period. Where
exactly. Yeah. That's why I was excited, as it's gonna be one of those games that I could save for this time. You know, end of quarter one, where things were quiet and there wasn't anything coming out, and I could really sink my teeth into it. And unfortunately, it just is not the case, so I'm kind of just bummed right now. I'm like, I think maybe I'll go to the Strong Bad adventure games or something, you know?
Well, we like those too, so.
Definitely. So, yeah. What about Gary?
Same old for me. I've actually been really busy with work lately, so I haven't had much time to play anything. I'm still waiting to get to Fallout 3, which has been begging to be played for a while now, but... for me, right now, I don't have a lot of time to kind of sit down and kind of devote hours to playing. So for me, my biggest thing is still Team Fortress 2, Dust Bowl. I will boot it up. I will find a Dust Bowl server that's got a bunch of people in it and play Dust Bowl for, you know, 20 minutes or half an hour or whatever, and then I've had my fill. And that's it. Like, it's really weird the way that my interest in that game has kind of narrowed. I don't even like to play the other maps. I like to play one map. I play always a pyro or an engineer, and I do my thing, and I'm quite adept on that one map in that limited role, and I enjoy playing that. It's a bit sad, really, but that's how I get my kicks. I still need to play Left 4 Dead, and I've been, like I said, very slowly working my way through the very very beginning of Red Alert 3, refamiliarizing myself with the tutorials. It's been a long time since I played an RTS, so I kind of need to do the tutorials over, just. Refresh myself on the basics, but I'll get into that. I'll play through the campaigns.
I love the tutorials in that. The tutorials were actually pretty entertaining with the dialogues.
Yeah, although sometimes I just wanted to get on with it, you know.
But I think that you're in for a treat with Fallout, Gary, when you get around to that. We declared it our game of the year for a reason.
Yeah, and I'll be playing it on the 360, so unlike you, I won't be wrestling with display drivers and crashes all the time.
No, I actually finally finished and fixed my crashing problems. It was a problem with quad core processors, apparently, that not everybody, but a lot of people are running into.
How long did it take you to diagnose that and fix it?
It was a while. I was kind of waiting for a patch to fix it, and after two patches didn't fix it, I looked it up, and I think one of the patches made it worse, but. But yeah,
so what did you have to do? Turn some of the cores off or something?
Yeah, essentially, you have to go into an INI file and tell it not to use a couple of to only use two cores for, I think, just the AI is the main problem. But if you go into the podcast thread for last episode 163, I posted the instructions there. And it's completely fixed my problem, and it hasn't crashed on me since. So that's drastically improved the experience. But just the fact that I was so hooked on it that I was willing to endure those crashes to play it is a pretty strong endorsement right there.
What have you been playing, though? Yeah.
Well, I played Operation Anchorage last night, and you know, the Fallout 3 DLC, which was okay, but I don't know if it's worth $10. You know, it's kind of a diversion within the game. It's kind of similar to the other simulation in there, which is Evergreen Terrace, or not Evergreen Terrace, that's where the Simpsons live. but it's like a black and white kind of Leave It to Beaver-esque simulation.
Oh, so the color palette is sort of adjusted for the operation Anchorage?
It doesn't change like the like a, it doesn't put like a filter over it. It just you're in a snowy area in Alaska. So
oh, okay.
It looks dramatically different from the rest of the game, and also the gameplay is much different. It's not about killing guys and collecting their stuff, because when you kill somebody, their body disappears. Like, you know, it's kind of like a holodeck on Star Trek. You know, you kill a hologram and it falls down and vanishes, kind of, along with all of its equipment, and like items are strewn around and kind of glowing red, like in a shooter. And it's much more of a straightforward combat kind of thing. No real role playing required. You're not using much like lock picking or science skill or anything like that. There's a couple places where you do, but it's very straightforward shootery. And you know, it's not bad. It's just not great. You know, hopefully they'll cut the price on it a little bit later, and then it'll be worth it. I've also been playing. I'm working on a review for Tom Clancy's End War, which is finally coming out for PC. The voice control so far seems like a bit of a gimmick. I mean, it's nothing you couldn't do with a mouse and keyboard. On the console, it's probably more significant because they don't have a mouse.
I was surprised that it worked, though.
It does work pretty well.
You know, it puts you through the... It makes you do a little bit of voice training first, you know, where you have to say a bunch of phrases and sentences so it recognizes the way you pronounce certain things. But then once you've done that, it's kind of surprising in the year 2009 that I'm amazed that basic voice recognition works. But it's never really been that good.
Yeah.
And to have even a vaguely reliable system in a game, it is gimmicky. But I was just surprised that it worked as well as it did.
Yeah, I mean, it does, like, the setup for it is you have to say unit 1 attack hostile 3, you know, and it kind of labels them for you, so you know which one's which. Although it doesn't really do a good job of telling you which hostile is which unless you mouse over it. Which it's like, if I have to mouse over it to see which one is which, why don't I just click on it? Which is kind of annoying. But it kind of sometimes, like, if you just say unit 1 attack hostile 3, it won't. Really pick that up, because it hears it all kind of as one word, so you speak a little bit more slowly. And I find myself doing kind of a William Shatner impersonation. It's like unit 1 attack hostile 3. You know, so and my girlfriend got really angry at me for talking at my computer all night while she was trying to sleep. So my hours of playing that one are kind of limited. So I guess that'll wrap it up for this week. We gave you an extra long one to tide you over. We'll be back next week, same time. And if you want to call in and leave us a question, we will certainly do our best to get it on the air. The number Andy will tell you, because I can never remember it.
Yeah, it's 1-877-404-1337, and the extension is 724, which is PCG, stands for PCG, or like on your touchtone. You know what I'm saying.
I think we can figure it out. Our listeners are smart people. We've also got you can make an MP3 of your question and send it to pcgamer@gmail.com.
pcgamerpodcast@gmail.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
You are right.
Yep.
And we're also going to be putting up some screenshots, like a screenshot of the month in the magazine now. We're trying some of that stuff. So,
well, that's cool.
So if you take a cool screenshot and you want to submit it to the magazine, you can send it to letters@pcgamer.com. And to subscribe to the magazine, if you don't already, you can go to gamesradar.com/PC and scroll down on the left side. There will be a link to subscribe. So for everybody here, we will see you all next week. Thanks for joining in.